Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. Got my
mojo working, but hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Have a lot to share. We're going to be talking about conversations with remarkable minds. This is one of our most, if not the most popular series that is done here. And today we're going to talk with Dr. David Corton. He is the co-founder of Yes Magazine and co-chair of the New Economy Working Group. We're going to talk about our self-destructive postmodern industrial and free market story and myth, and the need to change the story to one that values the lives of others and animals and the planet. This will be a longer version than normal. I'll give it at least half hour. A short newsmaker with Dr. Tony Bark, B-A-R-K. She's a pediatric board-certified physician, and she's going to give us the latest on vaccine updates and what we should know. In light of what's going on around the country today and in the near future, the New Jersey state bills aim to eliminate your religious exemptions from vaccines. So you need to let your legislators know, and I'll get into that also. And of course, we always start with the latest on health and healing. Now, here's some good news for those of you who eat your broccoli or broccoli sprouts, even more powerful, or take any of your broccoli powders. This is according to the University of Utah, the Health Science Center, actually University of Texas. Quote, the world's longest-lived rodents don't eat broccoli, but they have the protection of a protein that in humans is activated by consuming broccoli. That's according to a new study. Researchers from the Barship Institute for Longevity and Aging Studies measured signaling of the protein called NRF2, and they found that the maximum lifespan is enhanced when we eat broccoli. So, one more reason to have your broccoli, and I try to get my broccoli every day in some form. Ideally, you get your organic broccoli, steam it, because then it becomes more bioavailable. You're actually improving on it. Then put some lemon juice on it and some extra virgin olive oil, a little Himalayan sea salt, and your favorite spice. And then have that in a salad. Also, a new report from University of Texas Health Science Center says that frequency of drinking diet soda to increases in your waist. Now, that should be a contradiction. Why? Because the diet sodas are supposed to have no calories. Therefore, you can have it. More benefit to you because you're not having the sodas that have all the sugar. Well, this says not true. Quote, those who drink diet soda thinking it will help them shed unwanted belly fat may see their waistlines expand instead. A new analysis from an observational study of men and women at the Longevity Center. So, evidently, what is in the diet sodas disrupts our normal metabolism, and that causes weight gain, even in the absence of the extra calories. Also, a very common antidepressant actually increased coronary atherosclerosis in an animal model. This is from Wake Forest Medical Center. Quote, a commonly prescribed antidepressant caused up to a 600% increase in atherosclerosis plaque in the coronary arteries of non-human primates. That's the latest. The published article was in Psychosomatic Medicine. Now think of how many people are on these antidepressants. Tens of millions. And the latest study yesterday showed that 70% of them don't even have real depression, and hence they're taking something that has very devastating side effects and will ultimately hurt them. Well, now we know it goes beyond that. It really hurts them because you increase your risk of dying of a heart attack or a stroke. Now, if you remember yesterday, I said that the problem in American diet is not the high cholesterol and fat, but rather inflammation due to chemicals, how we cook foods, and proteins, the excess amount of proteins, and the alteration of the protein for through cooking. That's what actually causes the problem. And then I went through in detail how that happens, and oxidation of fats, and how by taking your antioxidants, vitamin E, vitamin C, coenzyme Q10, zinc, you're able to trap a lot of those free radicals. One of the best free radical neutralizers is alpha-lipoic acid. It's a terrific way of doing it. But if you just had 4 glasses of fresh-made vegetable juice a day, and you put some lemon juice from fresh lemons, and some vitamin C, about 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams, up to bowel tolerance, and you drank those juices, you would be trapping and neutralizing the free radicals that lead to oxidative stress. And it's the oxidative stress that damages your epithelium and leads to atherosclerosis and the plaque buildup. And then your the aggregate coming together of your fats, and then you have a heart attack or stroke. So now the antidepressants will do that for you. But there's something else about these antipsychotic medications. According to Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics, as of today, quote, antipsychotic use may increase the risk of diabetes in children. Well, first of all, why are any children taking antipsychotic medication? They may be disruptive. They may be curious. They may be exuberant. They may be on a caffeine high, but they're not psychotic. And yet, by pathologizing all children, then you end up able to give them these antipsychotic medications. And then, of course, a lot of them kill themselves, or they walk into a school and kill the other children and kill themselves. 95% of all mass murders, all, including the French pilot or the German pilot, were on antipsychotic medication or antidepressants. And yet the media refuses to touch it. Because of who controls the media? Big Pharma. You probably, if you were born in the 1950s or 60s, you probably have had your tonsils taken out. And that's unfortunate because your tonsils actually are important in your body. We were told they're just useless appendages that cause the body a problem. Not true. In fact, you could avoid tonsillectomies and save your immune system. And here's the latest from Organic Lifestyle. The tonsils are part of our immune system, that we know, the visible part of your lymphatic system. They provide the first line of defense for pathogens swallowed or inhaled. Specialized cells in the surface of the tonsils capture pathogens, allowing B cells and T cells to attack them. Tonsil tissue is similar to other lymphatic tissue, what we call lymph nodes, found under the arms and around the groin. The purpose of tonsils is to clear the area of toxins. They are vigorous in their immunological defense. So why do we perform up to 250,000 tonsillectomies a year in the United States? Your child has frequent bouts of strep throat. So we're told, get rid of the tonsils and put the kid under general anesthesia and cut them out. Once again, conventional medicine treats a symptom, not a cause. If your child's tonsils are enlarged or your child presents with frequent strep infections, the question is not whether or not to rip out the tonsils. The question is what is causing the infection. Back in the days when my family and I embraced, let's say at that time, conventional medicine, most people, I know my parents did, they never questioned the doctor's recommendations. Today, people will get their tonsils out without asking about the immune system and the role of the tonsils. So what I'm suggesting is this. When you start seeing strep, give your child some Manuka honey. Put in a little bee propolis. Give them some green tea with fresh lemon juice in it. Give them some wild oregano oil diluted in water, and some vitamin C with quercetin, some Powdiarco and Echinacea and Astragalus, and olive leaf extract. That will protect the tonsils, kill the strep and staph. And if you want something a little stronger, then give your child a shot of ginger and lemon and wheatgrass juice with some Manuka honey in it and have them gargle that. That'll kill it. And if you want the super-duper powerful strep and staph killer, then take some fresh garlic, fresh onions, juice about 2 ounces, add lemon juice, Manuka honey, and sip that. Now, no one's going to get close to you, but at least you're going to kill off the factors that are causing the problem. We've heard an apple a day keeps a doctor away. True. But now we're going to have to add in pomegranate and dates. Keep the doctor away. This is from the Technion Israel Institute of Technology. They're saying that that wonderful red pomegranate, which is native to the Middle East, as is the toffee-like dates, not only are delicious, but they're really a boost to your health. Now, when you take dates and pomegranate together, which you could easily do, you could dice them up into your organic oatmeal or put them in your smoothie, then you do a great deal of good because the juice of the pomegranate and the dates protect you against atherosclerosis, plaque buildup, or hardening of the arteries, which can cause heart attack and stroke. The findings are published in the peer-reviewed Food and Function, a journal of the Royal Society of Chemistry. So one more thing we can do that is not expensive, very tasty, and save our lives. And finally, working up a sweat, it could save your life. From James Cook University in Australia, quote, physical activity that makes you puff and sweat is key to avoiding an early death. That's a large Australian study found. They followed 204,542 people. Wow, that's a lot of people for 6 years. And compared those who engaged in only moderate activity, like gentle swimming or social tennis or household chores, with those who included at least some vigorous exercise, jogging, aerobics, competitive tennis. They found that the risk of death for those who included vigorous activity was substantially lower. So, quote, the benefits of vigorous activity applied to men and women of all ages and were independent of the total amount of time spent active reduced the risk of mortality. So get in some vigorous activity every day. This is a big study, 200,000 people for 6 years. It's important. And one last thing, according to a study out of Asia, consuming peanuts, of course we're talking about organic peanuts, can help prevent foodborne illnesses caused by intestinal bacteria pathogens. The study published by the Institute of Food Technologists found that white peanuts assist in improving human gut microflora, as well as reducing foodborne bacterial pathogens like E. coli and Salmonella. Now, why is that? Because there are some chemicals in the peanut shell. There are two major portions, the brown thin skin and the white kernel. In the study, researchers from the University of Maryland found that the kernel, or the kernel powder, also called peanut flour, has prebiotic, meaning good bacteria effects. The findings show that if you were to have some peanuts, you would end up stimulating good probiotics, and that would be terrific. And that was published in the Journal of Food Science. Oh, and for the gentleman who stopped me in the airport yesterday and said, "Don't I know you?" And I said, "I don't know if you know me. Weren't you on PBS?" "Yeah." "Okay, got a question for you. I asked my doctor about coenzyme Q10. He said, it doesn't do anything." And I said, "Well, that's your doctor. That's his opinion. Now, do you want to know what the actual science shows?" "Yeah, well, the science shows that you could have a terrific amount of benefit for your heart. It increases the benefits to your heart. It can, in fact, the newest study shows that it can save severe heart failure patients from premature death." And that's a matter of fact. It's been studied. There are thousands of studies on coenzyme Q10, ubiquinone. And if more heart patients are educated about coenzyme Q10 and how much to take and what form to take, we could have a lot less people dying of heart disease. I suggest 100 milligrams morning, afternoon, and night, unless you have a heart condition, then, or dementia, or Alzheimer's, then it can go up substantially. That's the latest on health and healing. And now, Dr. Tony Bark. Dr. Bark is a highly respected pediatric physician, and she has published in the literature, and she was a very strong pro-vaccine advocate, having vaccinated a lot of people during her residency and in her earlier part of her career at New York University. And she also has degrees, by the way, in psychology and also from Boston University's medical school. And she is concerned, Dr. Bark is concerned that physicians are not taking the time to educate themselves. And she is one who has spent thousands of hours educating herself about the truth about vaccines, their safety and efficacy. Let's get the latest now. She's on the road traveling. She's on her cell phone, but she's taking the time for this little newsmaker segment. Nice to have you with us today, Tony.
Hi, good morning. It's still morning, Tony, where I am, so good morning.
Okay. Tony, around the country, including today in California, coming up in New Jersey, there are bills that are trying to eliminate any exemptions. You'll have no choice but to take your vaccines. You won't be able to tell your doctor, my kid can have those vaccines, my child has some immune compromised conditions that the package insert says are contraindicated. Won't matter. You could say, I have three children, two of whom I vaccinated, and they have autism spectrum disorder. I want to save the third. Won't matter. You won't have a choice. You could say, the package insert does not show that this is healthy. It shows all these side effects. Won't matter. So we're approaching complete fascism in medicine. And the irony, Tony, is the liberal community, the corporate left, MSNBC, Mother Jones, the Nation.
Even Credo.
I mean, I think every card-carrying liberal has to stand up now and say, we're as fascistic as the right when it comes to vaccines. I am so disappointed. I shouldn't be, because they've been stupid in the past, including their voting for Clinton and Obama. But in this one, this is about children and parents, and we're not going to have any rights whatsoever. And that seems to please them to no end in supporting Big Pharma.
Right.
Have you ever seen anything so asinine in your life?
Well, okay. So this is the issue. It's very interesting because, as you know or may not know, I've flown around. I testified. Our testimony went missing. This was in Minnesota in the Senate committee hearing. It's very interesting that the senators who answer my letters are Republican. And I've analyzed what I think is going on. First of all, the people on the left, like Credo and Tom Filippo and Mother Jones and MSNBC, they think they're doing the right thing. Now, in general, Republicans don't like overreach of government. They don't want the government telling them what to do with their children, their bodies, unless it's a woman's vagina and uterus. That's another story. That's the one exception that I've seen. But in general, they don't like the government overreach. And this is the interesting part. Republicans totally get that the regulatory agencies can be captured because they captured the EPA a long time ago. So they don't find it a stretch to think that the CDC might have been captured or the NIH might have been captured. The Dems, on the other hand, do not believe that these regulatory agencies that are there to protect us have been captured, although to some degree, many of them are split on the GMO thing. They'll somehow, they can fathom that the food section at the FDA, those in charge of food at the FDA might be captured. They can even fathom that even the drug department at the FDA could be captured. But for some reason, when it comes to the CDC and the NIH, they absolutely do not believe in that there's regulatory capture, and they think this is the best thing. So they have good intentions. The intentions are there. They're incredibly misguided. And it's really split in terms of ethicists. So very left-wing ethicists tend to be more towards taking away rights, whereas more right-wing ethicists are against forced vaccination, and it's very interesting on this issue. But I do believe it's coming from good intent, albeit very, very misguided and very misinformed, incredibly misinformed. And your point about not being able to get exemption. So in many states, it is to do away with whatever conscientious or religious exemption is there. In other states that have a big Republican base, they know they can't get away with that. And so what they're doing is just adding one more step for you to go get that conscientious or religious objection. And that is to go get, quote unquote, educated by the physicians. And we all know it is the physicians who need the education. But these bills were in place and all written in 36 states. There's over 100 bills. They were all written. They're all the same wording. And so these were in place a year ago. And I believe that this was all in response to the fact that Merck is under siege. They've got two federal law cases against them, one for fraud and one for monopolizing, which is, I forgot the term, but it's for antitrust, exactly. And then the
restraint
other thing
trade,
is that Merck...
Restraint of Trade, Antitrust Act.
Yeah, it's the antitrust. It's the Antitrust Act. And that's if the fraud goes through, then there's the antitrust thrown on top of it. It's two separate law firms. But then you've got the CDC whistleblower. And I think that Merck and the CDC panicked and said, before, if this ever, all these things get out to the public in any wide-reaching way, we'll be screwed. We need to implement these laws that erode rights for exemption now, while we can. And so they took, and the next measles case, they decided this was planned, that we will, they'll follow what they did with smoking. How did we get people to stop smoking? We shame them. We made them social pariahs. And so the plan was, let's have a huge campaign that makes people who question vaccines social pariahs. And let's do this with as much money and power as we can. And that's what they did. It was a media campaign. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of cases of measles in many years. It's really a no biggie. Most of them are vaccinated. Many of them are, it's the vaccine strain. Those of us who follow this understand that. So they just took the next case and, or the next few cases and ran with it. But these bills were in place prior, and it was really in response to the fact that these, you know, the cases against them were unsealed, and then the CDC whistleblower had come forward, and that was a huge threat to them. And so that's what these bills are in response to. And for legislators who are listening, they need to understand that medical exemptions have been all but impossible to be gotten in terms of there's very few doctors who will write them, and then the doctors who do write them, which I'm one of, they're no longer accepted by the state because the CDC now says, even if, well, you said if your children are damaged, even if two children have died, accepted death from vaccine as a vaccine reaction, it happens, they die within hours, it's accepted. That is not enough medical exemption for your next child to have exemption from the vaccine. Even deaths of previous siblings known to be from a vaccination is not enough for our government to exempt you. So it's so extreme and so tyrannical that for those people who get it, people are talking about leaving the country. That's
this
how bad
is the,
it is.
This is the latest from Christine Sarich, who does some great reporting. This ties into what you are suggesting. Just shows you how corrupt big business is. Quote, dare to publish a scientific study against big biotech and Monsanto will defame and discredit you. For the first time, a Monsanto employee admits that there is an entire department within the corporation with the simple task of, quote, discrediting and debunking scientists who speak out against GMOs. The World Health Organization recently classified glyphosate, a chemical Monsanto's best-selling herbicide Roundup, as carcinogenic, news that is really heating things up with biotech. So Monsanto has been demanding that the World Health Organization and the International Agency for Research on Cancer retract their statements about the poison's toxicity to human health. The company demands this even though a peer-reviewed study published in the current issue of The Lancet Oncology conducted an analysis providing the evidence that glyphosate was indeed a probable carcinogen. So,
and
here
they'll
we
probably
have,
wind up retracting it. You know,
so
that's how much power they have.
But this is every single industry has now front groups. You can see the same people going on to every one of the liberal or conservative stations when an issue comes up, no matter what the issue is. Paul Offit
right.
is everywhere, unchallenged, by the way. And if he does have a challenge, it's all by a layperson, but you won't see Paul Offit debating you. You won't see him debating.
No, no, they won't debate. So their MO is they will never debate because they know they can't win. They won't debate, and they won't even sue people for, you know, people write, oh, another, you know, Offit's killed another baby with this vaccine. You know, they can't come forward and file a suit against somebody because they know it would go to court for saying that, and then there'd be evidence brought to court. So, no, they do not want to debate tête-à-tête. That's never going to happen. But just let me remind you that the AMA claimed that cigarettes were good for you and safe and didn't cause cancer until the very end. Until the very end. So, like, in the late 70s, their position was cigarettes were not causing cancer. They had been paid by the tobacco industry. This is what's going on. And the other issue is the reason we haven't heard the CDC whistleblower in Congress in front of a congressional committee is that the committees are all afraid to be the committee to hear him. Because I've looked at how much every committee member and the heads of these committees who would be appropriate to hear this CDC whistleblower, how much they've received from pharma. Pharma is the number one donor to everybody's campaign. In many cases, the congressional lead head of government oversight received over $300,000. I mean, there's so much money riding on this that if you are the committee that listens to the CDC whistleblower, I'm sure you've been told, it's quite understood, that none of you will get funding this next election cycle. So this is what we're up against. We're up against pharma now is the number one contributor to everybody's campaign. You can look it up. There's websites, Open Secrets, that show how much everyone received from what industry and who's the biggest donor. And at the top of just about everybody's list is pharma. And in many cases, for some small congressional, you know, runner, it's a few hundred thousand. Sometimes it's only 50,000, but many times it's 300,000 or more. So, you know, how do we fight that when you need millions of dollars to run just for a seat in Congress? And they're funding, they're the major funder for your campaign. How are we going to get whistleblowers even heard?
Okay, well, you've raised two questions. I know you're busy and on the road, but I want to ask you the most important question. Let's back it into position. First, the media is completely culpable, left and right.
Well, they're owned by pharma.
Yeah, on this issue. Well, some are not owned by pharma, like The Nation magazine. It's just filled with the most arrogant group of hubris-driven people. They will never acknowledge they're wrong about this, and yet their advice could end up causing death, injury, and they don't give a damn, like most of the people.
Well, they don't know. They don't believe it. So either people don't believe it because they don't bother to actually read the
they're
studies.
Tony, you represent the exception to a group of narcissists and pediatricians who are in the front line of injecting people. I can no longer accept the argument from you or anyone else, and I will never accept it again. We were well-intentioned, but we killed the people. No, if you're well-intentioned, you're not killing people. You're looking for the evidence that is out there based upon the controversies that arise, based upon the radical concept that what you might be doing could be hurting people, and you have a moral, ethical responsibility to see, is the nature of my practice contributing to disease or the wellness of the patient? Now, since there are doctors like you, and Dr. Susan Humphreys told me recently that she spent 12,000 hours studying the safety and efficacy of vaccines before she came to the decision that they're unsafe, all of them, and she would never recommend any vaccine for anyone. But it was 12,000 hours. How many other doctors
no,
willing
I
to
get
put themselves
it. I,
through
I
that?
Know. Well,
right. So,
you know, so
no
hear
more
you.
Apologies for anyone doing stupid things. If the nation does
them.
Something, if the nation, should not exist, in my opinion, when it comes to giving us advice on health issues. If they want to tell us what
right.
to believe politically, and they want their people who believe in that, fine. They're the ones who gave us Al Gore as a candidate, and John Kerry, and Barack Obama, and Bill Clinton, and Hillary Clinton, and whoever's up there who's a you know, who's a lover of Wall Street, they will not, they'll find a reason to support him. Will they ever endorse a truly independent person like Rocky Anderson or Jill Stein or Gary Johnson? Or no, they won't, because
they would rather
have a lobotomy than to acknowledge
right.
they're wrong about anything. That's why I can't even have a conversation with them anymore because of this, but that's fine. They're not the only people
but
in the room
know,
to have a conversation with.
People walk around unconscious. A lot of this, I mean, I'm not an apologist for them. They're unconscious. I mean, most people make decisions and there's a lot of self-deception going on. I talk to pediatricians who say, I don't even want to know. If I start looking at it, I'd have to change my whole life. And they're really fearful. I mean, and then others who just, you know, get angry when I bring it up because They won't look it. They refuse, and it's a lot of self-deception, which is terrible. It's horrible. I'm not excusing them. It's really pathetic. But most people walk around
from unconscious positions. Tony, then they shouldn't be practicing medicine, because we're not talking about having a political plan. You're talking about a child's life. And I want to ask you, do you believe that your opinion is more important than a child's life living and dying?
Of course not. I think that,
you're a handful of doctors in America, as the rest are the number one cause of death. And it's time they were called out. It's time that they were held accountable. It's time that they were shamed, since there doesn't seem to be any other way to reach them.
And that's also true for much of
the liberal media. Now, here's my last question for you.
Sure.
After all your research, because you too told me in New York, if I'm not mistaken,
I don't stop reading.
You said thousands upon thousands of studies. You said that you looked at every single study you could find in the world over the last 20 years. You said you spent at least 5,000 hours before you became an activist on this issue. So here's my question. Based upon your review of the scientific literature, are vaccines individually or collectively safe and effective for any given individual?
And the answer is probably not. I think there are people who have very little effect from it, but the risk of the contamination and again, I'm not a germ theorist, so you know, you can have these oncogenic viruses that in some people and in the right epigenetic situations like the food will stimulate cancers, and there's other people who won't, just like exposure to lead. But they are potentially all contaminated. They do potentially shift everything from TH1 to TH2, which increases autoimmunity. They do decrease innate immunity for a few months, which is never a good thing for anybody, because you're now at risk for several weeks to months after receiving a vaccine. And most contain NMDA receptor toxins, which can lead to autoantibodies and anything from psychosis to death to autism to just ADHD and ADD. So I don't recommend them. I can't give them. I can't in good conscience give one or take one anymore.
Okay, good. Fair enough. You've been honest and straight, and I appreciate that. Now, my final thought, and I don't need you to respond to it. I just want you to think about it. If you gave every patient you see, let's say you saw 1,000 patients, you gave every one 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C, and at the end of the year, not a single person developed a cold or flu, but historically they have, you have no real proof that it was the vitamin C that prevented that cold. You might surmise. You have a hypothesis that has to be tested.
Now, right, exactly.
The same is true for all vaccines without any exception. When you give a vaccine to a person, if they do not come down with a disease, you cannot ever in honest science say that vaccine prevented that. That is fraudulent science.
I agree.
Okay.
100%.
All right. I just want... As a scientist, I am so sick of scientists. I'm sick of the paradigm that our only truth is a scientifically verified truth, when you start off by buying the science. Therefore, you bought the truth. Therefore, wherever you want people to believe, you now have the mechanisms, and you have the media, and you have the thinking people in universities who, God, if you thought they couldn't be compromised, they are compromised by the gazillions. So it's up to the individual
to
trust themselves. Tony Bark, thank you very much for being on.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a great day,
Dr. Tony Bark, B-A-R-K. Her website is disease-reversal.com. Let's now say hello to Dr. David Corton. David is the co-founder of Yes Magazine and co-chair of the New Economy Working Group, and founder and president of the Living Economies Forum, and a member of the Club of Rome, and a founding associate of the International Forum of Globalization with Jerry Mander. And in the past, he's been a faculty member of Harvard University's Graduate School of Business and an advisor to Harvard Central American Institute in Nicaragua. And he spent 15 years in Southeast Asia with the Ford Foundation and serving as its Asian Regional Advisor on Development. And he became disillusioned with government and large private international aid programs, so he shifted his focus, something that a lot of people are doing now, by the way, and realizing that all they've been doing is enabling, not transforming a crisis. He is the author of Change the Story, Change the Future, A Living Economy for the Earth. His websites are livingeconomiesforum.org and yesmagazine.org. Nice to have you with us today, David.
Well, delighted to be back with you, Gary.
David, I don't feel people fully realize how much they live their lives based upon stories, scenarios, and myths that we subconsciously fabricate for themselves. And every political party lives by a story that it believes the nation and the world should be based upon. And science and Wall Street do the same thing, as does every world religion. Environmental, civil rights, and anti-war activists live similarly according to stories in opposition to the dominant paradigm that controls the national and international discourses. So as you've written and lectured on for many years, there is a dominant story today that is leading humanity to its own self-destruction. And we can take this conversation in multiple directions, but I'd like to hear your comments about the free market economic story that is overriding the others, because this story, based upon infinite growth and progress and founded upon a hierarchical structure, foments inequality and injustice and corporate rule by a very small elite. Richard Gale and I estimate it to be about 147 corporations and about 3,000 individuals. So it's not 1%, it's 1/100 of 1%, and seems to be tied to all the pending disasters, including climate change, the emergence of a police state, perpetual war. So please begin speaking on the power of the stories we accept, and then define for us this prevailing story founded upon the sacredness of money, privilege, and status, unlimited growth, and the incentive to protect this story by any means, including military repression. The forum is yours.
How much time do we have, Gary?
All you need.
Okay. You know, the first thing we need to recognize is that living by stories is integral to our nature. You know, we can call it culture, but it is the basis of our ability to live together and organize together as human societies. Now, in the earliest societies, of course, these stories emerged out of the collective experience of the tribe. And they are so natural to our being that, as you note, we just live by them without really questioning. And it leaves us very susceptible to manipulation by people who are in a position to control and manipulate the stories of the society, like for obviously the mass media. Now, the piece that we're caught up in currently, it's so fascinating because it is. It also has ancient roots. One of the most interesting Bible verses is the verse that says, "No one can serve two masters. Either you serve God or Mammon," which really, to me, comes down to either you serve life or you serve money. And it is that juxtaposition that we are caught in right at the moment. And we are living what I call a sacred money and markets story. I'm quite fascinated that Pope Francis, his homily on, it's not money that is evil, it is the worship of money that is evil, the idolatry of money, the worship of a false god. And we literally have developed a society devoted to the worship of money. And it is framed by a sacred money and market story that is taught and repeated in our universities through economics courses, and of course constantly repeated through the corporate media and advertising. And it, you know, people recognize it immediately, but, you know, let me just go through and outline it. The critical elements are, first of all, time is money. Money is wealth. Making money creates wealth. Making money is the defining purpose of work, of people, of business, and of the economy. The richer society's wealth creators. Affluent lifestyles are their fair and just reward for their contribution. Material consumption drives prosperity and is the path to happiness. Poverty is a consequence of laziness. The earth belongs to us. It is our human nature to be individualistic, competitive, and greedy. Fortunately, guided by the invisible hand of the free market, these beneficial traits unleash the creative potential of humanity to grow the economy, to grow, create the wealth, to end poverty, to drive the technological innovation required to eliminate our dependence on nature. The community interest is simply an aggregation of the individual private interests of its individual members. We therefore all do best when we each seek only to maximize our individual private interest expressed through private financial gain. Corporations, which are just groups of people working in common cause, are engines of wealth creation, and they are entitled to the same rights as any person. Well, these are just a few of the most familiar elements of that story, and any thoughtful person listening to it and deconstructing it realizes that every single element of that story is either patently false or grossly misleading. And yet it is so pervasive, and it comes from such authority. Those of us, and I think it is most of humanity, who on reflection recognize that it is totally false, are reluctant to speak up and speak the truth in their heart because the experts and everyone else seems to be believing it, seems to be living by it, and therefore if I speak up, I will be perceived as somehow stupid or crazy. Now, to me, one key here is that the true story, which is the story that we are living beings, born of and nurtured by a living earth, itself born of a living universe, is a story that I believe lives in the human heart. It goes back to the most ancient of indigenous traditions. And I find if I get into a conversation with most any person who has not been totally warped by the culture, they recognize it immediately as their own story. So I'm operating on the theory that if we can simply confirm what is actually in people's hearts, we can quickly expose the prevailing story for what it is, begin to bring forth the new story that what I call the sacred life and living earth story, which starts with the recognition that time is not money, time is life. Real wealth is living wealth. Money's just a number. It's very useful as a medium of exchange in well-regulated markets, but it is not of no value in itself. We humans are living beings born of and nurtured by a living earth, born of a living universe. Then we begin to get into our scientific understanding of life at a deeper level, that life exists only in community. We humans exist only as part of nature, not apart from nature. Earth does not belong to us. We belong to Earth. Our health and prosperity depend on Earth's health and prosperity. Our human nature, properly understood, in fact, calls us to care and share for the benefit of all because that is essential to our survival. Serving the living community that sustains us is essential to community health, and it is the source of our greatest happiness. Individualistic greed, ruthless competition, and violence against life are actually indicators of serious psychological and social dysfunction. This should be a cause for great concern. Not for celebration as we celebrate the Wall Street banksters. Poverty is most often the consequence of a lack of opportunity resulting from a deeply dysfunctional economic system. The purpose of any human institution, whether it be business, government, or civil society, is to support people as productive, contributing, sharing members of a vibrant and prosperous living earth community. Corporations that seek to monopolize resources and decision-making power in the pursuit of purely financial ends have no place in a healthy society. So that's basically how I'm setting up the frame that these are the kind of defining nuggets of the of my most recent book, Change the Story, Change the Future. And I think getting that part right is critical. Now, it goes into questions about the need to update our deeper cosmologies, which is also a subject I know you're interested in and happy to get into if you'd like to go there.
Sure. I appreciate that overview, David. Many scholars of religion and mythology have researched and written how the myths and stories you talk about that underpin the emergence of a modern industrial civilization and the rise of capitalism severed humans' relationship to the planet and nature. Nature became kind of a dead, unconscious, material thing to be exploited for humans' benefits only, and that has been a leading reason why we have embarked upon this horrible self-destructive course. However, it is not sufficient to try to lecture to people that our relationship with the Earth is not what the economists and corporate executives tell us. We can't simply continue to force the natural processes of life to serve our needs without piling up serious consequences. The blowback has occurred. The tipping points have tipped. And even in California, we have right now tens of thousands of people listening to this program in California. I'll bet less than 1%, having heard me for the last 7 years, say that you're running out of water, and finally they've run out of water. They haven't looked at the consequences. They don't want to bring themselves to that point where they have to change. Now, if you ask them, "Or do you believe in change?" Yes, I believe in change. Would you like to see A, B, and C? Yes. Are you willing to sacrifice anything in your own life or become uncomfortable for a period of time to be that change? No. I believe, for example, David, that we're going to see the people leaving California first from the gated communities, of which there are hundreds of gated communities, thousands of gated communities in a state of about 38 million people, because that's where the developers went. They bought large tracts of desert. They tapped into the aquifers and drained the water. They built these golf courses and lush, beautiful gated communities that cost anywhere from $500,000 to $10 million for a house in one. They have golf courses, have to use all those pesticides and water. Well, now that everyone in the state, except for gas hydrofracking and for agriculture, has to cut down by 25%, you're going to see green golf courses go to brown. Then someone's not going to like where they're living. Then they're going to say, "Why are we living here when we can live in Naples, Florida, someplace else that has water and nice golfing?" So you're going to see an exodus of people over a period of the next 2 years. And by 2 years from now, you're going to have the necessary industries consolidating, using the water, but people still not getting the idea. Are we in the wrong place? Yeah, you're living in a desert. But won't it be lush again? No, it's never going to be lush again. It's going to become what it once was, and it's going to be a desert. No matter what anyone tells you, the governor, legislators, they don't want you to freaking leave because that's their tax base. They pay their bills through their bureaucracies and public services based upon your property tax. So if your property value goes down and it's going to crash, you're going to see the biggest land crash in America. Mind you, this isn't an earthquake that they can rebuild from. This isn't a tsunami that they can recover from. This will not be something that people in California can recover from. So looking at it from this perspective, what is the new story that needs to be shared more, and what are the best ways to frame this story so it sinks into people's ethical consciousness? And in your answer, also speak about the spiritual dimension that we need to honor that connects the fate of humanity more deeply with the fate of the Earth.
Okay. First of all, let me say that the scenarios are dire, and I have no illusions about the difficulty of the and depth of the change that we need to navigate. I often tell people when they ask me, "Do you think that we have a chance to get out of this?" I say, "Well, if I look at it purely objectively, no. We've already gone beyond the bounds. We are destroying Earth's capacity to support life, particularly human life, and we are so deep into our old stories, there's no change." But I also realize that to take that position creates a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I believe we have to hold to the idea that we can change, that there are answers, and we must apply ourselves fully to making that happen. Now, the chances are that we will suffer the collapse anyway. But I take, you know, the comfort I find is that what we need to do in terms of recovery, and this is assuming we do not destroy Earth's generative systems to such a level that it will take millions, if not billions, of years for Earth to recover from our presence and demise. The solutions we will need to have to reorganize, to regroup whoever of us are left, are essentially the same as the things that we need to do now to try to prevent the collapse. Now, in terms of the deeper story, to me, it is fundamentally the frame of living Earth, that Earth is a living being, a living organism, and that goes to the deepest cosmologies, that the mechanistic view of science, it's so interesting that the distant patriarch cosmology of conventional Abrahamic religion and the science story that it's all just a dead machine, Earth's a dead rock, happens to be infested with these living critters that sort of came out of nowhere, that both of those stories separate us from nature. They separate us from the true reality. And it's so fascinating that if you actually follow the science story of creation, it's not the story of a giant clock winding down. It is the story of a living seed bursting forth into a grand and flowering tree. The whole story of the universe as we understand it from science, it starts out with the explosion of energy particles, but it's a constant process of, from there, of organizing toward ever greater complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility. And every stage of the evolution of the universe follows that basic trajectory as if it's a process of learning. And I believe that, you know, intelligence, the real story is that intelligence and awareness, some form of consciousness, is pervasive throughout all of creation. And it is a self-organizing process, a process of self-discovery, of becoming, and that every being is a part of that. And, of course, we see this with our understanding of the evolution of life on Earth, also starting with the simplest of organisms that self-organized in conjunction with the geological processes of Earth, through processes with which we have the barest understanding, to transform the total surface of Earth, including sequestering excess carbons and toxins deep underground, preparing the conditions on this planet, unique to this planet alone of all that we know in the universe, that created the conditions for humans to evolve. Now, we need to recognize that we are a part of a continuation of that process. Earth was not created for us to exploit. We were created to contribute to the continued unfolding of that grandest of all adventures of creation. And we need to recognize that Earth is continuously self-organizing to maintain the conditions of our existence. And yet we organize an economy that is devoted to working against nature. The most incredible thing is that we apply our best minds and resources to taking those toxins and those excess carbons out from their deep sequestration, releasing them back onto the surface of the planet, all in a futile effort to suppress and control and exploit the very natural processes that are essential to our existence. And that, of course, brings us back to the story of water in California, that we have simply treated it as somehow a gift free to exploit, totally oblivious to the fact that as living beings, we absolutely depend on Earth's capacity to continuously regenerate that, and that we need to work in ways that support that regeneration and live within the means of our share of that generative product.
David, we're out of time. I agree with that. I just believe that It is too late for most people in California. There will always be water in California, but it will only be for those who can afford it and who have the political clout to get it. Others should start looking for more sustainable environments to live in. Thank you very much for this conversation, David. I look forward to our next one.
Thank you.
Dr. David Korten, K-O-R-T-E-N, my guest from Seattle. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program.